This story's right, this story's true. I do not tell lies to you, like the promise they did not keep. And how they passed us in like sheep. Said to the bus, come take care of him. Set us up on a mission name. Told us to read the right and pray. Then they took the children away, the children away. The children away. Snaps on them on this grace, tell us it's for the best of them away.
Good morning and welcome to the Carol Cox Show. Thank you for joining me. Aloha to all of you. Today I was reaching out into Canada to speak with a gentleman, Mr. Kevin Arnett, and he's going to be kind enough to share some time with us. And this is regarding reportedly some 50,000 children, Native Aboriginal children in Canada, died at the hands of church members, church leaders, or whatever. And we want to get more information, and there's a project to investigate this, and Mr. Arnett is quite active and actively involved in this process, and I thought it would be nice to share with you another view of what really goes on and what other people are doing around the country, around the world. So good morning, Mr. Arnett. How are you?
Good morning. Thanks for having me, Carol.
Yes, I really appreciate you taking the time to share with us. And can you give us a little background about yourself? I understand you were with the United Church and or were actively involved and was a minister of sort, or pastor, or as we call them here. And if you could, give us a little information on yourself. And then what does this project involve?
Well, it goes back almost 20 years. I was, for 7 years, I was a United Church clergyman before being expelled from that church without cause when I began to surface these stories of what had gone on in their Indian boarding school. In 1992, I went out to the West Coast with my young family at the time. I began to work in a community on Vancouver Island, Port Alberni, which had been the center of a lot of this, the missionary work, the Protestant and Catholic missionaries in the late 1800s. I began to meet Native people and invite them into my church, and it was there and in their homes that I began to learn that many of their relatives had actually died in the local United and Catholic residential school. So I began to ask questions about it. I was told in no uncertain terms to be quiet about it by the church higher-ups. They were denying everything at that point. That was before any of these lawsuits had ever begun. So the church felt free to just deny everything and warn me not to look into this. But I persisted on the side, you know, beginning to document these things. I was eventually fired after almost 3 years because I discovered that there'd been a whole kind of backroom deal going on where the church had been selling off native land that the missionaries had stolen to various logging companies and getting money for it. And I wrote to the church about that, and I was fired. I was the only minister in church history to ever be defrocked publicly at the tune of about $250,000. I mean, this was happening right at the time in 1996 when the first lawsuits were being brought by survivors of the Indian Residential School. So, you know, it was at a time where the church definitely didn't want this stuff to come out, as really they still don't.
Mm-hmm.
And I documented this on work over the years in books, in a documentary film called Unrepentant. And in a nutshell, now I'm working with survivors not only in Canada but all over the world who have suffered these kinds of crimes in churches and other institutions. People can follow that story. We have a film called Unrepentant, which you can view at hiddenfromhistory.org. And the other work is actually all my documented evidence of this is posted online at hiddennolonger.com, where you can read, for example, that in these residential schools, over half the children die. Not just accidentally, but because the church staff were deliberately exposing children who were healthy to children who were sick and dying of tuberculosis and then never treating them. This was even described by government doctors,
mm-hmm.
and that accounted for a death rate of nearly 50%. So we estimate over 50,000 children died in these schools over a century, and yet not one person has ever been brought to trial in Canada for the death of a child. So this is an ongoing criminal investigation, and you know, I'm still very immersed in it after almost 20
mm-hmm.
years.
Now, I will go out and say openly, I believe, personally, in my opinion, this is genocide, planned genocide. Is there anyone sharing that same opinion out there, speaking to describe the situation?
Well, you know, it's a proven fact that it was genocide, because if you look at the United Nations definition of genocide under Article 2 of the Genocide Convention from 1948, they say there are five things which constitute genocide, and all five of those have been documented to have occurred in Indian boarding schools, not just in Canada, but in the United States, and in Hawaii, and wherever there was indigenous populations that were conquered by Europeans.
Mm-hmm.
And things like not only killing people, but transferring children from one group to another and leaving them there, preventing birth, like sterilization programs, which did go on in Indian hospitals in Canada. We've got evidence of that. Creating conditions that are going to kill people off over the long run, like taking away their land and language and that kind of thing. So, yeah, I agree that it's proven to have been genocide, but the problem is these institutions are still in power, and that's been the roadblock all along. You know, the system is not going to indict itself. We need international courts of justice to rule on this, and this is what we've been trying to get.
Mm-hmm. Now, the churches involved, who are they, Roman Catholic, and who else?
It was predominantly Roman Catholic. About two-thirds of these Indian boarding schools were Catholic, but it was also Protestant, the Church of England, the Anglican Church, and the United Church of Canada, which was Presbyterian and Methodist. So, you know, all the main denominations were involved in this, in collusion with the government, which authorized and legalized these schools.
Mm-hmm. And Canada has, the Canadian government has the Truth and Reconciliation Commission, right?
It's the Truth Commission in name only. When you look at their mandate, they don't have the power to subpoena. They don't allow people to name names or bring out evidence of wrongdoing. And they can't sue the churches over this. It's kind of like they're talking around the issue,
mm-hmm.
without ever holding anybody accountable. And they've also disqualified over half of the survivors from receiving any compensation. So it's not, you know, the word an apology is one thing, but the real question is, what are you going to do to follow up the word?
Mm-hmm.
And there's been nothing really on the ground to actually stop what's going on and return what was taken from people, like their language and their land and other things.
Mm-hmm. Now, in these schools, in reading, children suffered beatings, electric shock, these are some of the claims, forced sterilization, medical experimentation, starvation, rape, as well as various other forms of sexual abuse and murder. Some spoke of young girls becoming pregnant as a result of rape, or nuns becoming pregnant after sexually abusing boys. How will that ever be addressed? Is this Reconciliation Commission just to put a Band-Aid on, a social Band-Aid?
I believe the way it'll be addressed is by having an international inquiry with the full power to investigate, to exhume graves, to do forensic analysis, all of the things that are now being blocked by the Canadian government through its Truth and Reconciliation Commission, which has no mandate to do any of that.
Mm-hmm.
So we've been trying to get international effort. It's beginning to happen. We've had European politicians say that if we can provide the forensic evidence about these mass graves, for example, of children near the school, they will begin an inquiry of their own and possibly bring charges against Canada in the European Parliament for these things. Where I am at right now, I'm calling you from Brantford, Ontario, which was the site of the oldest Indian residential school among the Mohawk people. And we've already identified these graves, and we're using ground-penetrating radar and actual excavations to begin to exhume them with the permission of the local Mohawk elders. So this process has begun. The only issue is how much backing is it going to get so that the world knows about this.
Mm-hmm.
And, that's at this point still problematic.
Mm-hmm. Is there any outreach to the American government or politicians, of Congress or Senate or the President to offer assistance or ask assistance in this?
Yes, there has been. In 2008, the network I work with in Canada among Indigenous people wrote to the President and the Senate in the United States. Just like we wrote to the United Nations, we sent letters to the Queen of England and the Pope, since they were the main, responsible officers of these corporations that caused these crimes. We didn't hear back from anybody. And again, I think it's an indication that these aren't just crimes of the past. The child abuse that's been actually one of the reasons the Pope is under such pressure right now is because he personally has been implicated in concealing the sexual assault on children in the Catholic Church,
mm-hmm.
under a policy which actually orders priests to cover up that abuse rather than tell the police. So there's some American lawyers that are trying to sue the Pope for that reason, and I think Obama's Attorney General actually seems to be siding with the Vatican on the claim that they're immune from prosecution. So, I think this is politics, and I'm not sure how many governments are willing to take this issue on because
mm-hmm.
of their own history.
Mm-hmm. Well, we got to start somewhere. If we can teach the others, then we can teach ourselves, or at least good start. But on the number of schools and how many were there, and when did they start, and when did they end, or are they still in existence?
At the peak in Canada, there were 134 schools, and these were set up jointly by the government and the churches. They were set up in the 1890s. The last one closed in 1996, so this is over 100 years of history. They formally closed, and yet the conditions continue among Native families. For example, children are still taken away en masse from Native families and put in white foster homes, where the process of deculturalizing continues. They lose their language and their sense of identity. In many ways, you could say that the death rate and the rate of suffering is still very high because of this whole legacy. And the kind of random violence against Native people, including the deaths of Native people in prison, the fact that over a third of all Native people, the prison population in Canada is Native, when they're only 2% of the population. I mean, this is the kind of statistic really you get Indigenous people anywhere in the world.
Mm-hmm.
And those, crimes really are continuing, but under a different guise. And so you could say, I often hear in Native healing circles people say, yeah, well, the residential school never ended for us because we're still treated the same way in many ways.
Mm-hmm. And the process of selecting, is it a random selection, or how do the churches and the authorities select the children from?
I'm sorry, I can't hear you.
How are these schools or the children selected for these schools? You there? I'm asking, how were the schools selected and how were the children selected for these schools?
I'm sorry, I can't hear you at all. Something's happened to the volume or something. You're at. I can't hear your words.
Okay.
Should I try calling back?
Yeah, try calling back if you can do that again.
Okay, I will.
Thank you. Technology. It's good, and then it's great. But the thing what we're trying to get now is to, and this is the Carol Cox Show, and we're talking with Mr. Kevin Arnett, who is with the an effort to look into the murder of death of some 50,000 children in regional schools in Canada. Good morning again, Kevin.
Hi there.
Yes, you hear me okay?
I can now, yes.
Okay, well, the question I had was, how were the children selected? Were they randomly selected, or is there a process? What's the process for these
schools? There was a federal law brought in 1920 ordering that every child older than 7 had to be incarcerated in these places. And if the parents didn't surrender the children, the parents would go to jail. They also had to sign over guardianship rights of their own child to the principal of the school, the clergyman around the school. And so, yeah, it was a federal law. In many cases, children a lot younger than 7 were gathered up. So over a quarter of a million children went through that process, and like I say, around half never returned. They died under the control of these churches.
Mm-hmm. Now, I'm reading some of the documentation that I've gathered from various sources, and one claim that just jumps out is that the United Church may have knowledge of a pedophile ring associated with the Vancouver Club, which involves United Church clergy, lawyers, and judges. Can you elaborate on that? Give some insight.
We held our first public tribunal in June 1998 in Vancouver, and at that tribunal, in a closed session, we had the opportunity for people to give their testimony in secret in a room. Two eyewitnesses came forward who claimed that Squamish Indian children from the northern part of Vancouver were being taken down regularly to the back of the Vancouver Club. We had a native Aboriginal reporter who had actually documented that. He had also an attempted lawsuit brought against the Vancouver Club by native families. And all of that evidence was reported in 1994 by not only newspapers in Vancouver, but a lawyer called Jack Cram attempted to sue various judges and church lawyers who he named in a lawsuit in April 1994 in the Supreme Court in British Columbia. Well, his case was thrown out of court. He was charged with violating his oath of, as a lawyer, and he was actually arrested and incarcerated for 3 days in a psych hospital in Vancouver. And during that time, the photographic evidence which he claimed to have of this pedophile ring disappeared from his office. So, you know, this is not just hearsay. This was an attempt in court with photographic evidence of these events. And, you know, I think the fact that it was shut down so effectively is, you know, proof of what we're talking about.
Mm-hmm. Now, there is evidence being presented that there was a mass grave. There's a mass grave where a great number of children were taken to the back of the church and killed. Can you share with us that incident or the suspicions behind it?
Yes. Well, first of all, there's a lot of people's stories of this. We were able, on the basis of those stories and surveys we have done at a number of schools in Western Canada, where forensic experts have come in and looked at the ground, identified sinkholes and ground disturbances with ground penetrating radar, like we're doing right here in Brantford as I speak. On the basis of that, we identified 28 sites in Canada where there are suspected mass graves. And from what we've already found here, there was to give an example, today I was speaking to a woman, Lorna McNaughton, who identified a mass grave. We've already done some surface tests and found children's bones. A local archaeologist confirmed that it was human remains mixed in with the remnants of potash, which years ago was used as a fertilizer to decay human flesh. Like, you know, they would throw it in among bodies and that. So fairly strong evidence that, yes, there were bodies there and some kind of body-dissolving agent was used in the mass grave. So this is the stuff we're beginning to document, and we intend to post by the new year.
Mm-hmm.
For the world and other agencies to look at.
Again, if you could, the sources and where you will be posting in your website, can you give that information again?
Yeah, the main website to look at is our International Tribunal in the Crimes of Church and State. It's itccf.org, and hiddenfromhistory.org is our main website. And this evidence, again, on the third website is hiddennolonger.com.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Now, one story that I read about where there was a child, a sister's telling of an incident where she personally witnessed the teacher striking herself and her sister while hitting her sister on the head with a 2x4, she describes it. And the sister was sick and... You there? Well, we lost him again, but calling from Canada, I guess the whales swim across the line. Okay, you there, Kevin?
I am. I'm sorry you faded out again.
That's okay. We're in good shape. A pot of whales probably swam over the line or something. But that's what we do here. But the story that I was speaking about, if you could share with us, where there was a sister, I think you interviewed or someone else interviewed, the sister witnessed herself, her sister being hit over the head with a 2x4.
Yep.
And the story, as it states, that they... The body was shipped back, and they had removed the brain for a suspicious thing to happen to prevent detection that the actual abuse occurred. Can you share that story?
Yeah, there was a young girl, Vicky Stewart, who, according to her family, there were two eyewitnesses. Her two sisters saw the incident at a United Church residential school in Edmonton in 1958. They saw an employee of the school, Ann Kaniski, hit Vicky on the back of the head with a 2x4 because she wasn't coming into school fast enough. The next morning she died after a lot of bad headaches and vomiting during the night. They claim she died of tuberculosis. They issued a statement, although no death certificate about that, just a statement. And they still claim that fact, even though these eyewitnesses say that, yeah, they saw her get killed, and then later her body was definitely missing the brain. We believe that the brain was removed to hide the evidence of the blow to the head. The RCMP, the Royal Canadian Mounted Police, like they do in all of these cases, refused to investigate. They claimed the perpetrator was dead, and they just wouldn't even look into documents or any, you know, if there had been any accomplices or anything. They just refused to investigate the claim, which, you know, is not unusual. That tends to be what happens in these cases.
And, wow. If we were to get involved, or my listeners or our listeners here were interested, who could they write to, or who would you like, what would you like them to do, or donations or what have you, to help fund your efforts, or who's funding your efforts?
Well, the best thing for them to do is to write to me directly. My email is kevin_annett, A-N-N-E-T-T, at hotmail.com. There's a list of things they can do on our website, hiddenfromhistory.org. I think the important thing is, because Hawaii had a tradition of indigenous people and their conquest as well, try to link up with native groups that are addressing the same crimes, because there were Indian boarding schools all through the United States as well, the same strategy of the destruction of the culture and the language and taking the land of the native people. But we're also attempting to link up with survivors today of crimes within the church. And so if people would like to help us with that network, there's a lot they can do. Just write to me, kevin_annett, A-N-N-E-T-T, at hotmail.com, and I can share a lot more information with you.
Mm-hmm.
And keep updated on our work at itccf.org.
Mm-hmm. Kevin, on these schools, how long did the children have to stay there, and what happened to them once they, I hate to use the term, graduated? What can you tell us what would happen, how they, when they went there, then when they finished, what happened to them?
Well, it's important, you know, to remember these were not schools. Children had rudimentary education of an hour or two a day, and the rest of the time they were used as cheap labor in the fields, as domestic servants. They were really internment camps, and they were incarcerated there as young as 3 or 4 years old. They would usually stay till they were 16 or 18. They would stay years in these institutions without any contact with their families. After leaving, almost universally, people were not able to hold jobs. They didn't go on and get a higher education. That's why there's so many problems in the native world, and they pass those problems on to their children. So we have this as a huge tsunami, if you like, that's gone right through the native world and is continuing to affect generations. So it's important to remember these are like survivors of concentration camps. They're not in any way in a school. They weren't part of an education system, and that's they're called schools because of a definite spin operation by the government and the churches to make it seem like that's what they were doing. But when you look on the ground, and this is being shown in documents and many testimonies, that no, they were not receiving any kind of actual schooling.
Mm-hmm. I saw some of the pictures and video where they were in the laundry rooms and working on the farms. And you there? Okay, again, it went out on us, so they're such a long distance, and up there I think their antenna, or who knows. Okay, Kevin, thank you again. You there?
Yes, I'm here.
Okay. I apologize for whatever it is. It's a technical issue and satellite issues, but you there?
Yes.
Oh, okay. I hear the clicking. Anyway, about blackouts, are you meeting any resistance in getting the word out, or can you describe if there is any interference on the part of government or what have you?
Oh, there's been a long misinformation and dirty tricks campaign, definitely, on the part of the government towards this. As early as 1996, everything from, harassment, threatening eyewitnesses, putting out false stories. The media generally will not cover this at all in Canada. Occasionally, like when the Prime Minister made his pseudo-apology back in 2008, there was a little bit of media interest. But by and large, to give an example, we sent out a mass press release when we began to open these graves here in Brantford last month. Not a single Canadian media responded. We got no phone calls. There was no one coming by. Now, you think opening mass graves, suspected mass graves, would be a story. But there's a complete shutdown on this. The only way we've been able to get the story out is through radio programs like yours and the alternative media and the Internet.
Mm-hmm.
And that's really the only way the world is learning about these things.
And to access some of these churches, when you say the schools, are you meeting any resistance there? Are they? Surely not all of them are open arms to you, but are you getting any cooperation?
Cooperation from who?
From the churches or the schools to allow you to go in and explore the graves?
No. The churches have refused right from the beginning to share any documents, to acknowledge anything, or to allow access to the grounds of these schools. So. That also happened in the United States, where in Omak, Washington, a suspected gravesite of children and babies who had been buried there by Jesuit priests, the police said that we needed permission of the Catholic Church to go on the grounds. I mean, since when does the suspected criminal get to decide whether they're going to be investigated or not? But it shows you the power of these churches. They're protected, immune from prosecution, in effect. And that's why we need to go outside the country to bring in pressure to find out what really happened. Because under the government's Truth and Reconciliation Commission, which they set up, they have no mandate to investigate these things, and they don't have subpoena power. So the churches aren't compelled to share anything if they don't want to.
And so the British Crown, what was its role? Did it grant so much authority that now it's a hindrance to people like you who are trying to reconcile things?
No, the British Crown authorized these schools from the beginning, and as did the Vatican. Like I say, those are the two kind of main fiduciary offices that are responsible for these things. The school right here in Brantford was set up by the Church of England in 1832, and its express purpose was to wipe out Mohawk culture and to take the land, which is really what was the agenda behind a lot of this.
Mm-hmm. I don't know what to say. And the Aboriginal leaders, have actually embraced you and given your name. Eagle, what was it?
I've been given a name by the Ojibwe people, Eagle Strong Boy, and also the name Rawanasani by the Mohawk Confederacy, which means powerful voice that warns the people.
Mm-hmm.
And the thing to remember is that there's really two native societies in Canada. The official government-funded native leaders, which don't generally support this work, and then the majority of traditional elders, clan mothers and traditional elders who don't recognize the government system, and they tend to be the ones on the ground who support this work, my work, and the investigation.
Mm-hmm. Well, let them know we support them here. But in looking at this this entire effort on yours, I applaud you and others, because it's something that should come to the surface. And it is a struggle. Something like this, no one wants to come out, and especially if they're still in power. But if you could, a lot of the listeners may think that this is an attempt to strike out at a system. But can you share with, for example, they have the tribal agent, and I read somewhere where even the rules that were projected on the native people, for example, farming, they couldn't use any mechanical implements, only handmade implements, things of that nature. Can you speak to anything of that?
Well, no, there's an attempt right from the beginning to keep native people in an uneducated slave-like status. I've even found letters within the residential school system where there was one example of five young boys who one of the local teachers wanted to help fund their way to college. And an instruction came right back from the government in Ottawa saying either their post-high school education is not to be funded, because if they became educated, the Indians would compete for jobs with white people, and we can't have that. That was in 1948, after World War II. So in relatively recent history, there's a definite policy, not just, you know, random decisions by different teachers or whoever, but a policy right from the nation's capital to say we will not allow Native people to be educated. That's genocide. That's an attempt to keep people in a subordinate state as non-citizens. And still under the Indian Act of Canada, they're not citizens. They're wards of the state. So it shows you that these policies are continuing.
Mm-hmm. And it seems to run a parallel or similar treatment that we receive here in Hawaii and in America. And what we see in this whole effort was that even veterans, that native people in Canada that's participated and went off to war, even they were met with adversity when they returned. They couldn't go. There were rules prohibiting them to go into pool halls. They couldn't go to the veteran affairs where normal and the whites could go. They could only go to the reservation and participate, and that information wasn't sufficient. And
hi there.
Good morning again. I'm just speaking on the veterans that went off to war on behalf of Canada, and how the native people, how they were treated when they returned.
Well, when you became a soldier as a native person, you lost your treaty rights and your identity as a native. It was called enfranchisement. So you, once you served in the army, you could no longer claim that you were a native person. So at that time, you couldn't vote. So you really lost your identity as a native person, but you gained very little in return. That was a policy going back well into the 1800s, where the native people were given a choice. Either you extinguish yourself, you go off your land, you forget your culture, or you're not allowed any protection, which meant in practice that anybody could come and kill you and there wouldn't be any consequence. And, you know, that was kind of the blackmail still today. If you want to receive any government money, you've got to live on reservation. Yet while on reservation, you have no rights under the law.
Mm-hmm.
So it's a catch-22 for most natives.
And if you wanted to open a business on the reserve, you would have to submit application and wait, I'm told, approximately.
Right.
It could end up 2 years or so. Is that correct?
Well, it's even worse than that. One man in the government, the Minister of Indian Affairs, decides whether you can operate. They can take your business at any time. They can evict you from your home. They can dispel the band council. They can compel involuntary hospitalization. I mean, you have no legal rights when you live on reservation.
And again, without implying that the Canadian government is negligent or participating, can you, a Canadian citizen, can you describe how would you describe the relationship with the government, the Canadian government, and how they're treating this?
The native government?
Well, no, the Canadian government itself.
The Canadian government?
Yes. If, in a nutshell, if you could share with us, without us drawing our own conclusion.
I didn't get everything. What is the relationship of the Canadian government?
Yeah, and how do they view this? Are they really concerned with taking care of this matter, or are they also blocking it and just hoping it go away? Can you?
Oh, well, no. The Canadian government has been actively hostile to any of this coming out from the very beginning.
Mm-hmm.
At one point, they not only were denying they even ran the schools, but they were denying the children had died and all of that. When the lawsuits began to prove that wrong, they then set up this fake inquiry in order to contain the whole thing. They basically have done this. They said to every survivor in Canada, if you sign off any legal action against us and allow a gag order to be imposed on you, we will give you $10,000 in return for your silence. And that's what they call reconciliation and healing. So it's designed to protect the institutions, the churches and government, while gagging the eyewitnesses. And, I mean, that's been proven time and again. So, I mean, that's to be expected out of a regime that you know, had genocidal policies. They're trying to protect themselves. You know, and again, you can assume that this is going to happen, which is why we need... There isn't any justice within Canada to achieve on this. The courts have refused to rule on the issue of genocide. They call the what went on in these internment camps for children, they called it denial of education, but it wasn't genocide. It wasn't a crime against humanity, even though half these children died.
Wow. And so we're seeing the allegations were that by incarcerating a great many of the Native people, the incarceration benefits the government financially, because there would be money given to the Native people or the Native person. But if you were to incarcerate that individual, the government itself, the Canadian government, would benefit. I'm speaking about the incarceration of the Native people, and the allegation is that the government itself benefits from incarcerating a great many of the Native people.
Mm-hmm.
Can you give a little more detail than that, or is that inaccurate?
Well, it's pretty accurate, because, first of all, under the Indian Act, if a Native person is put in jail, all of the money the government had to pay to them doesn't go to their family or to the local band council. It reverts to the government. So in other words, they're saving money by having Indians in prison.
Mm-hmm.
You know, there's also a whole industry around the criminalization of Indians. There's a lot of social workers and police and everything who are employed by this. So they're a growth industry. I mean, that's why 2% of the population comprise a third of all prisoners. No one's ever given a reason why that would be. There's a whole assumption that, well, Native people are just more criminal by nature or something, and they have a lot of social problems which cause this. But no one's asking how, you know, where the social problems came from and how they're being maintained. Where I work in Vancouver, there's clearly two standards when it has to do with the seizure of children. A Native mother can lose her children simply on the basis of one random complaint, which they don't even have to follow any procedure. They go in and literally seize the children. A white woman has to have a formal review. There's a lawyer involved and everything. So Native children are continually being taken out of their homes, and they disappear. This one woman I worked with hadn't seen her children in 6 months, and she didn't know where they were. And they gave her no explanation of where they were. So it shows you that kind of double standard can happen when Indians aren't citizens under the law.
Mm-hmm.
And that's, you know, an example of what we're talking about.
So the genocide continues, and this whole process, it's alive and well, apparently.
Very much.
And is there any groups there, for example, the ACLU, not the American, but the Canadian Civil Liberties Union, is there any groups that are reaching out to protect the Native people other than yourself?
Well, there are community groups on the ground who try to do a lot of good work. The only problem is in Canada, all lawyers, even the watchdog agencies are employed by the Attorney General. These bodies all take oaths of allegiance to the Crown, just like judges and lawyers and everybody, and members of Parliament do. And in the case where the Crown is behind, is the cause of a lot of these things, there's kind of the unwritten understanding that, you know, you don't take on certain issues involving the culpability of the church and government for these crimes. So you find that, for example, groups that address the issue of genocide don't get funding from the government. They're squeezed out of existence in many ways. You know, they get harassed. I mean, this kind of thing is ongoing. So in effect, it's citizens on the ground who are really leading this whole campaign to hold the government and churches accountable. And they've made a lot of resistance. I mean, it's a continual, swimming against the stream process.
Well, it seems that the British government is suspect in this or have made great contributions. But as I look at this, I think of Australia, Hawaii, mm-hmm. and New Zealand. Seems like a great many people benefited, and they employed the same tactics. Would that be an accurate assumption?
Yeah, very accurate. I mean, ultimately, this was an issue of land and getting the land and not getting the indigenous population off the land. I mean, many of the people who I work with, over half the homeless population of Vancouver are Aboriginal. And when you talk to those men and women, they were forced off their land, often by their own chiefs, who are in collusion with large mining companies, lumber companies. About a quarter of all the fresh water in North America is in British Columbia, and it's on native land, and these people are forced off the land to get those rights, to exploit the resources. There's more oil in Canada in the Alberta tar sands than in all of Saudi Arabia. And again, Cree people sit on that land, so they're being continually made landless, and they drift to the cities, they have no support, they die at a very high rate. So, I mean, it's a classic kind of third world model right in Canada.
Right, our friends, right north of us. But I also, I said Australia and all, but right here in America, we've projected the same injuries on people and the genocide that took place or is taking place still yet. The jails here fill primarily with native people or Hawaiians, or a great number of them. So I guess the one common denominator is that we all come from the British origin. I don't know it. That seems to be the most common element. And the Catholic Church seems like they're quite involved in all of these types of things.
Yep. So it's very much the case, and there's a same identical history in America. The only real difference is in boarding schools in Canada, the churches had carte blanche to do anything they wanted. In America, it tended to be run more like from the Bureau of Indian Affairs, mm-hmm. Who took over from a lot of these missionary schools. But, the crimes were the same and the cover-up is the same.
Because the product that they're seeking is the same, the land and the resources. Well, folks, I apologize, and we just have to live with that. That is technology there, and he's calling from a long, long way away. And if you've been up there, it's a flat land, and some of it is country, and some of it is mountainous, but we'll take it as we can get it. Okay, go ahead, Kevin.
I'm sorry, I didn't hear the question. I had to come with it.
No, we were talking about the Catholic Church, and you had answered that, but... The one thing that jumps out at me is that, do you see any change in this? Anyway, we're trying, folks, so I appreciate your help in understanding this, and we'll get it done. But the squirrel can't run fast enough to keep the energy up.
Hello.
Yeah, go ahead, Kevin, and if you got any closing statements or anything you'd like to share with us, go ahead, and that way if we lose you, we'll know. And I appreciate you joining us and taking the time to go through this trouble.
Oh, no problem. I would say that for people listening, the best thing to do is just look over the basic evidence first at hiddennolonger.com on the Internet. You can download my whole book there.
Mm-hmm.
Look at our film on repentance, and also if you can help in this work, check our website, ipccs.org. We are getting increasing support from actually around the world, especially Europe. And I'm beginning to work in America a lot more now. And because Native nations, they span the border, they lived on across the territory. And so what I'd urge people to do is contact me, kevin_annett, A-N-N-E-T-T, @hotmail.com. And definitely we will keep you updated, because what our plan is in the spring, we're taking a lot of this evidence to Europe, to the European Parliament. And there'll be on April 8th, Easter Sunday in Rome, there's a convergence of survivors of these crimes from all over the world. So that's something definitely you can keep updated on at ICCCF.org.
Mm-hmm.
And I just thank you for having me on, and I'll certainly keep you updated.
Thank you so much, and I do appreciate you calling in and sharing with us. And if there's any way or any interest you have in calling back or in later months or whatever, please don't hesitate. Or give me an email, and we'll set it up.
I sure will. Thanks, Carol.
Hey, thank you, and aloha.
Set us up on mission name.
Okay, that was Mr. Archie Roach, a native Australian, who was singing that regarding the issues of regional schools, as Mr. Annette called it. And I no need to apologize, but for the inconvenience, but if you've been to Canada and some of the rural areas, you'd understand. I mean, we're lucky that he could make a complete sentence without being cut off. But again, having traveled to Canada and worked with many of the native people, and if you go to EnviroWatch, actually you can see where we are participating and have been for years on the clear-cutting and the injustices that are occurring. And I'll tell you, what is most striking about this process is that when we look at the Canadians, we see good people. But isn't it ironic that this is where Americans ran to avoid going to war? And just while accommodating the conscientious objectors, they are inflicting a greater injury on a people, on a native people, they being the Canadian government. So that continues with the theme of schizophrenic and what have you, and that we talk about here. Something's wrong here. And these are the same people, or the same government that is, quote, our allied forces. As we speak right now, they're there firing weapons and strategizing and trying to keep Muammar Gaddafi and his friends and camels and everyone else and the Iranians, and they're over there fighting this great valiant war to project and protect the world, but under their feet in their own homeland, they're walking on the head and in the blood of native people. So, again, for those of you that quite often say, what is my religion and all, and this is one of those reasons why I'm very fearful, not objecting, but fearful of religious rhetoric. Nothing to do with someone sitting in the clouds looking down on me, but the living things that occur, the atrocities that come out. And those of you that want to recruit others to join you in the churches and sing and praise God, look inward and ask yourselves, how can we see these things repeated so often, and we take issue when a person say, I'm a non-believer, while we can't see exactly what it is out there that you see when you believe in what you believe, but what we can see and feel is the emotional detriment, the hard-hitting examples of native people being just destroyed so that you and I can have a straighter freeway and burn a high-octane gas and buy a nice purse and a nice watch and make sure we get our DirecTV. People are dying so that you and I can believe in God and believe in an institution and pray to it, while we are taught to forget the crimes that we commit on others, on other human beings. So join me in the second hour, and we won't talk about that as much, but again, we need to get real, and we need, when allied forces show up at the door, just remember, they may not be mad at you, they may be mad at the action that the friends that you keep here in America, and then you take it around the world. So I'll be back shortly, so join you in the next hour.
Thank you for tuning in to the Carol Cox Show, heard every Sunday mornings from 8 a.m. to 10 a.m. right here on K108. Tune in again next time for the Carol Cox Show right here at KWAI Honolulu. It's time for the Carol Cox Show on K108, heard every Sunday from 8 a.m. to 10 a.m. If you have questions for Carol, our number here is 524-1080, 524-1080.
Okay, good morning again, and welcome back to the Carol Cox Show. Just a couple of things, and we'll get on with some of the local issues and concerns. But isn't it funny, speaking, when we look at this thing about Native people and the treatment they're receiving, but just not Native people, disproportionately, the numbers of Hawaiians, Native people, in jail. You look at the Marshallese, how they're being impacted. We tested our bombs in their backyard or in their front yard or probably in their home and the feeding areas that they gathered. And today, a great many of them are having to come here. And we see global warming and the increase of water, and we see that, and a great many of these things are occurring because of our actions or our inactions and our selfish ways. We know about, when we see the news, when was the last time in local news in the Pacific in the evening have you seen a TV station talk about global warming and its impact? When have you seen them go down and interview a citizen from the Marshallese and ask them outright, are you struggling to get medical care? No, what you see is when there's a crime committed or one of them is drunk and is arrested, you see that on the evening news. But you don't see the things that might shake us all and make us come to our senses, that we are contributing by not participating and speaking out against these things and going along and allowing our politicians to write letters and demand that the federal government pay them money to compensate for the offset of the Native people that came here from Marshallese and Marshall Islands. This entire process, not just in Canada, but all over. African Americans, same thing. Highest rate of incarceration. And there's many, many stories to be told, the disparity in the sentencing. You get caught with rock cocaine, you got big time sentence. You get caught with powder cocaine, you might get a hand wrapping, or you might end up just getting off and getting the record clean in a couple of years, because they found that most whites or non-blacks or minorities would do crack cocaine or rock cocaine, and whites did powder. And so it is not about, you know, a lot of you like to dismiss these things, the Republicans and everyone else, that they want something for nothing. No, something, what we want is justice across the board, because when you inflict injury and pain and suffrage on one person of color or that is not of white America, then you can easily draw a conclusion that there's disparity. There's something is triggering this, either hatred, racism, or something. And so we shouldn't be shy about it. And if we're going together in the churches and you're going to recruit people, be good, be soulful, do what's right. Don't put a blinder over your face. And for example, we know a living condition right now is that Penn State, that school is pretty much grounded in the religious faith. How could that happen when there are true believers, supposedly, in that? How can that happen when they go to these cathedrals and churches and pray and participate, and before games they pray, and when there are people, the less fortunate, can get abused by one of your own? And then you say, what? Those Native people, those minorities, they're causing trouble again. When in fact, if you took an honest look at this and you were honest to yourself, the prayers that you give wouldn't be about you anymore. the prayers that you give would be projected on the people that have been treated so wrongly, and that you're benefiting from the wrong treatment and the improper, unfair treatment. And let's just say it the way it is. And I know a great many of you are out there, quite great believers, and that's good. But I ask that you all look at this and start speaking out. There's no way we should allow Canada or anyone on this planet to behave in the fashion, and this is current now. See, the killing of the kids and the schooling and the extracting them from their families and ripping into them, that's an old practice, and some of you may dismiss it as something old, but it's still new. And when we incarcerate people and when we speak out, and this 99% and 1%, folks, what this is about is that it's the unraveling of the human kind. It's nothing to do with business. And so if we allow the current trend to continue, things will get worse and more people. And in these times, in this age, it won't just be based on native people or skin color or resources. It will be all inclusive. Whites, Asians, blacks, all of the above, unless you have money. We will move from the color brown to the color green. And that's what it's about. And if we have time to get away from that. But we also have some methods to get rid of that, and that is hold your clergy, hold your churches, hold the British Empire or whatever. And when Prince Harry goes to Walmart, let's just tell them to go to you know what. But we don't need to be, when we see Kate Middleton and the pretty hair and the pretty gowns, and we're worried about what gown she's going to wear to the picnic and what gown, and native people under their authority is being plucked from their families. You see how crazy this is? So I hope that all of you continue to pray and believe in, but project it on getting things right, making things right now, not the continual practice of killing and maiming and incarcerating and destroying people, the human spirit. So anyway, speaking of destroying the human spirit, let's take a little look here at the city government and the state government. Now, just recently, and we're changing tracks, and feel free to call in at 524-1080. I'll take any comments, or if you want to throw rocks at in this direction, please do so. 524-1080, and this will be posted up on Carol at carolcox.com. Now, you saw that, some of you may have seen that the Pacific Beach Hotel actually had a fire on the top of that building there. Now, what you didn't know and didn't come out in the news is that the Pacific Beach Hotel, and this is one of those things where we say, hip, hip, hooray, this was a state agency doing its job, what I'm about to tell you. The Department of Labor and Industrial Relations, Hawaii Occupational Safety and Health Division, actually just recently issued citations to the Pacific Beach Hotel. And the total amount of money that was charged and paid was $22,000 for the violations. And they were a great number of them, $22,567.50. And some of the violations were, there were at least 11. And they went through and did a good job of taking on this company, and this company was exposing people to some conditions that shouldn't be there. A 30-foot long by 4-foot wide mezzanine storage platform used to store plywood, sheets, cardboard boxes, and miscellaneous food and beverages supplies approximately 9 feet above the kitchen floor did not have load rating posted. And they were there citing them. So it suggests that there was a little carelessness on the part of this company, if it is consistent with what we're reading here. Periodic in-house safety inspections were not conducted so that new or previously missed hazards or failures, work practices, administrative controls were identified, the in-house inspection shall be conducted by individuals who are trained and recognize hazardous conditions and so forth and so on. So they really, there were some, they didn't have the proper training in alerting their workers to blood pathogens or blood-borne pathogens or the correct way of handling body fluids. The employer did not provide initial blood-borne pathogens training for employees with occupational exposure to blood-borne pathogens. So there were a number of violations there, and again, we strike out at the state agencies and government agencies and complain about them. But in this case, they actually took an action, and the issuance date of these violation notice was 10/19/2011, so quite recent. And we'll see what happens with this as things go on. And other things that have developed here, we see that that we're going to possibly be seeing more furloughs, believe it or not. These furloughs are anticipated. I'll let you hear, but here's a document that we received in the city now, city and summary, and possibly state, summary of bargaining unit one, tentative settlement agreement, July 1, 2011 to June 30th, 2013. 2-year contract, July 1, 2011 to 30th of June 2013. Effective 7/11/2011, the employees shall pay no more than 50% of the premium rates and administrative fees for health care coverage. 1 day of directed leave without pay, furlough, shall be taken by all employees for the health care coverage payment during the period of 7/1/11 to 12/1/11. Employees were paying 40% instead of 50% during the same period. So I don't know how the union members feel about this, if they've ratified it or actually passed it, but this document says it's tentative and it was voted on. One furlough day for health care costs, 12/1/11, to zero up to 13 furlough days, 12/1/11 to 6/30/12, may only be up to 2 furlough days per month. And it goes on, when an employee is required to report to work, the employee schedule furlough day off, the employee shall be paid overtime, and the furlough day shall not be rescheduled to a later date. So it's coming, folks, and while our great leaders were out there looking at the APEC and talking about all of the monies to come, apparently they're also going to be giving out money again because they can't manage anything, and instead of putting a couple millions along the Nimitz Highway, maybe they should have been spending and managing our fair. But who knows? What do I know about the business anyway? But now I talked to you a while back on the lieutenant governor's brother being given special treatment. He was promoted without any competition and what have you. Now, I have actually made a request some while back now, and the time has expired for a lot of time for them to respond. Documents on the selection. Well, the superintendent, Matsuyoshi, refuses to respond. I've also asked for documentation on the charter schools, because the federal government was recently here and criticized them and showed and gave them a document and the assessment that they were in violation. And if you look, while I'm waiting for my documents, you see a little chatter and they're running to preempt. But just know that the education department, the Department of Education here in this state, is pretty much in shambles at the top. Now, I know you probably say, but those are people that it was handpicked, and you know who handpicked them, so if that says a lot right there. You can look around you and see. We don't see any great decisions that are being made right now by Neil Abercrombie, so why should we think that the Board of Education and the Department of Education is going to do any better, because they're getting their ideas and directions from the governor because he handpicked them. So they're going to carry out. So the problem is, on several occasions now, I told you about the race to the top where they didn't comply and the state didn't meet the conditions, like other states that received the money, and people were suggesting maybe we take the money back. So what you have in the education department, I'll best describe it as the greatest collection of elitists that you could assemble. You couldn't spend the money as a collector to put together this, because there are legislators that participate in this process. There are employees, and I'm looking and doing research on the employees' role and their background and their educational background and their technical background. And a lot of them, they wouldn't qualify as busboys or bus girls or whatever you call them. But they're there in those positions because they knew someone. And this is what we're handing to our children, and the money is flowing in, folks. I mean, they're getting money left and right. But they're passing that money left and right over their shoulders to their friends and hiring special people that are not experienced. And I would like to see an audit done on just the qualifications on top, the people making the decision. And that's not happening. So this is a group of educated people, supposedly skilled in management, but they can't openly and be transparent voluntarily, and even when you request documents, they withhold them. And I will be getting documents one way or the other if I have to file a lawsuit here in the near future and request those documents. But again, you see, the governor didn't want the judicial selection list of judges to be public. And apparently the practice is he won't release anything. And to this day, I still have a request for a proclamation that I had requested, if there was a proclamation for fuel oil. And again, the governor's office ignored that request. And this is a UIPA request, like FOIA or Sunshine Act. So nothing has changed, in my opinion, and the way they're handling my request or communicating with me. And I believe that what I have to say matters. And nothing's changing. So I'm actually waiting to get that information, and I'll share that with all of you. But even in the federal system, here locally, when it comes to the military, you remember I told you that a great number of the military schools, all of them on this island, were flawed and had problems and did not meet the conditions or the standards that the federal government had set. Yet it is the state who handles these schools and handles the affairs that was being criticized. So they were either below standard or what have you. So across the board, you're not getting any education. We're going through the motion. And if you remember just recently when we did our story, the following week, I think, Matayoshi, the superintendent, appears in the paper in an opinion piece, and she had some parting comment that the people, the naysayers, should just wait and look, or something to that effect. We don't have time to wait and look when you're dealing with children and developing their minds and their education. We don't need to wait and look. What we need to do is look and see what your management skills are and what product are you producing, And is it impactful? Is it positive on the children and on the school system? Because we're tired of being last. But they came out and said, well, look, we got an improvement in reading and an improvement in math skills. Well, that didn't occur overnight. So I don't know why they would be taking credit for something that probably they had little or nothing to do with. It was their predecessors who had put something together, and that was a product. I don't know. But again, that is one of the bigger problems that we see here with the state and with the educational system. And I don't know if it's going to get better, but it just seems to be there's some things that are terribly wrong in the education system with the government handling it. I've made a request of the federal authorities to have an interview, to bring them on. This would have been about 2 months now. No response, but I'm told they're still looking to see, and I think that that information would be good to give us some insight into what is happening within the schools. And I just don't know what the answers are, but we'll see. And it sounds like today is the day that Carol tell you all of the shortcomings and the failings. Now, I talked last week about the EMS, Emergency Medical Services. Now, I want to share this with you so that you can see. I describe this as when you see an ambulance come up, you're hoping that these are trained people and you don't want any craziness. But there's a lot of craziness and dumb things occurring in the city government and the city office. So I'm told that there is a audit taking place of the EMS. That it's been completed, but they're waiting to finalize it. And it might be out before the end of the year. Now, I made a request for a fiscal year 2010, all of the documents relating to the budget, because there's some things that were purchased and some things that were done. I won't disclose them now, but I'm wanting to look at that. Now, for 2 weeks, they have 10 days to respond. 2 weeks. I've made the request. I've called the office. I initially met with great, it was positive. They will get me the documents. Never received them. Told them that I wanted to do the show and wanted to have the documents. Didn't receive them. Holiday came. Then I start this pursuit again. Monday I call asking for the documents. And instead of telling me that they don't have them, tell me, well, we got to check with the budget and fiscal services. This is the EMS. Budget and fiscal services refused to respond or call, so I called the director. He calls and says, well, you don't understand. I don't know what your concerns are, why you're looking at these people. It's not a, there's nothing wrong. Well, I just wanted the documents and for him to say nothing was wrong. And as I told you, the money that goes to the operating costs for the EMS is actually managed by the state health department. I asked the state health department if they had received the complaints that I had received, and they acknowledged receiving, but they hadn't done anything. And these complaints had gone out 3 months, but nothing had been done. So they're not concerned either, the state department of health. Now that I made a request, they're quite interested now and calling around and asking for documents. Well, back to the city. I asked for these documents. Finally, they decide, well, we have them, but we forward them to the Budget and Fiscal Services for approval, for their review of the documents. The problem is, this is an accounting process that should have been done a year ago or completed because the fiscal 10 is over. Fiscal year 10 is done. And still to date, not a single document, and what they tell me now is that the director is reviewing it. So there's some, just to describe to you, and not to be reckless, there's some serious cover-up, because this document should have been out there. They weren't doing anything with it, and it's old documents. Provide them so that we can continue our pursuit and looking for transparency. So that's what is happening with the EMS, and I will get back to you on that. I'm not going to let it go. And just sharing this with you, it's not a gripe session or say that poor, poor, pitiful me. I'm just trying to convey to you this is how the government in this town works. You're not told anything because you wouldn't know what to ask. And if you know what to ask and then make the mistake of asking, then you get the runaround. And that's not transparency. That is ludicrous. And so what happened is that I'm hoping now, I don't know if Marion Higa is going to initiate an investigation or an audit of the spending, but what I was told, actually, we don't really have any role in it. We just give them the money. This is the state offices, the health department is telling me this. So money comes in and they distribute it out, and it could be misused and no one cares. Money's being spent overtime at EMS, and the state doesn't care because they don't task them with identifying everything. So, again, we could have better service from EMS and probably have greater coverage and more efficiency if the state health department took it serious and managed these resources and demanded of the state, of the city, to avoid conflict and as being reported by a great number of the workers that are reporting to me and that have reported in complaints to Mayor Carlisle and others. And nothing is done. Absolutely nothing is done. And speaking of city business, I get an email, and this is regarding trash. And follow this. At the end of October 1, this was a citizen that called up and sent me an email. At the end of October 1, I was talking to the refuse department because I was aware of the agreement between the union and the city that if the Christmas and New Year's holiday fell on the weekend, there would be no work on the following Monday. Refuse pickup is on Mondays, and after December 19th, the next pickup would be January 9th. I called the city to complain, and on November 17th, the city referred the complaint to the refuse department. The result was that refuse garbage would not be picked up on Mondays following Christmas and New Year's. I called Stanley Chang's office when I should have called you instead. Anyway, I talked to Michael Leong, and he was going to start a paper trail on this problem. I also talked to others. Whatever you can do to resolve this. Now, what that means is that if they don't pick it up on December 19th, this community, and this is the Kaimuki area and Kapahulu, those areas, for these routes, will not have their trash picked up from December 19th to January 9th. Now, this is garbage now. This isn't green waste. This isn't blue bins with paper and bottles. This is garbage. And this is also coming on the... imagine trying to sustain yourself and tolerate and exist. You are going to deal with this from, you're going to have all the Christmas foods and garbage, then you're going to have New Year's. And then another week. How smelly is that? Good morning, caller. Comment or question?
Yeah, Carol. I see you got my email. Okay, the last garbage pickup will be December 19th. Mm-hmm. But it'll be 3 weeks before the next garbage is picked up. And I'm going around in circles trying to find people, you know, that'll call in and complain about this, and especially with the city, I'm having problems trying to find somebody that's going to do something.
You should have gone down to APEC, brother. You know.
I had a slight problem. Security service wouldn't even let me get in that area.
That's right, because you had a problem, a real problem, and that needed addressing, right?
That's right.
They weren't there addressing real problems. They were dealing with theoretical and dreams, right?
Right. Well, you know, the thing about it is we can always take our garbage and put it on the lawn of Honolulu Holly, and it'll get picked up.
But that's all Honolulu Holly gives us anyways, trash. Don't go adding to it, brother.
Get okay, thanks for getting my email.
But how about the neighbors in that? Are there others concerned? Or?
Oh, yeah. Well, what I've done, I tried to, rather than go house to house, I picked different streets that are affected.
Mm-hmm.
So in the Kapu'ulu area, I went as far from Montserrat all the way down to Hinano Street, talking to various people. And it's all this Kapu'ulu area. I haven't gone into the upper area because I know they have garbage pickup also on Monday.
Mm-hmm.
You know, on it. It's just me going around, and I'm doing so many things, but I'm trying to get in there, you know, and talk to as many people as I can. And, you know, somebody complain, and I guess if there's enough complaints, then we might get somebody to do something.
Wow.
You know, if you call into the city for the mayor's office and complain to them about this problem, they will refer you down. They say, well, we'll give it to the director, and the director will refer that problem back to the refuse department.
Wow.
So I kind of feel like the commercial where the guy says, this is Peggy, and the woman speaks to, says, let me speak to your supervisor.
Mm-hmm.
And they pass the phone around the whole room. Everybody says, transfer till he comes back, and the guy says, this is Peggy. You know, it's just going around in a big loop.
So that's why I didn't answer, this is Carol.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
But no, you stay on it, and I'll see what, I'll ask the city. But that's a long period of time, and those two holidays are Christmas and New Year's. And you know all the food waste. Imagine that smell.
Yeah, it's food waste, and then, you know, a lot of gifts and all that, so there's a lot of garbage goes in those cans.
Mm-hmm.
And we only have one can, and pickup is only once a week.
Mm-hmm.
Under the old system, where we had the manual pickup, well, we had our garbage pickup twice a week, but anyway, if Monday was a holiday for the garbage pickup, they would double up on the Tuesday, do their pickup, and then come back and pick up all the others.
Mm-hmm.
That was the manual system. Under the automated system, there are no provisions for this problem.
Mm-hmm.
At least that's what the refuse department told me.
Wow.
So it's a little bit of undersight on somebody's part.
Yeah. Well, we'll see. And what are you going to seek assistance from your city council people? Or?
Well, you know, you have a copy of my email. I emailed that to Ann Kobayashi. She's the counselor in this area.
Uh-huh.
You know, so this is a thing, and it's just sit and wait to see what happens.
Well, this is how I found out a little secret, and I'll share everybody. Don't tell anybody. But this is how you get things done. On this, you want to take care of this problem? Send the email and with an envelope and put a little money in it. Okay, it works. Hey, I'm telling you, man, don't let anybody know now. It actually works. So the higher the amount, the faster they'll do it for you.
Well, I have one of my neighbors down here is the Reverend Tipton. So,
mm-hmm.
You know, the thing about it is I went to him and talked to him and said, we need a little Jesus power to get some push going here.
Mm-hmm.
So I have a couple of churches talking about it.
Okay, well, good, because I can see the roof will be raised with the smell and the vermin and the rats and what have you attracted.
But it becomes a biohazard when that thing starts to rot.
Well, yeah, and it also, biohazard is that a lot of people there are also putting out waste because there are a lot of people that are sick,
mm-hmm.
Right? And you don't want that just sitting out there or waving in the wind and, you know, and they have radiation treatments, you know, chemotherapy patients, all kinds of things. Imagine?
Yeah, so, you know, the big problem is it's just got to be somebody's got to talk and say, hey, let's do something about it on the upper level. It's just finding that person that's going to make the decision.
Right. Well, the person that should have been making the decision is always on travel and vacation and what have you, and come back with a, you know, jock attitude. And, you know, I'm here, bro. You know, and we need better. So just remember, once we solve this, voting time will be coming around, and you need to send a strong message.
I didn't include that in the, you know, I'm one of the constituents that vote for you.
Yeah. Yeah, well, we need to remind them of that. But, you know, okay. Well, thank you. And keep me posted, and I'll send a tickler, too.
Okay, Carol. Take care.
All righty. Hello. Well, you know, it's not what I say, it's what they do. And as you can see, they're not doing. And if you think that I'm being abrasive or foul-mouthed or rude, I want you to try connect the dots for yourself. I see it every day, all day. People call me, and the number of failures that are demonstrated through the government give me cause to go out and speak about it. Now, I wish I could be a little more articulate and kind in my comments, but it's just, I get it from all sides. People like you, the listeners, one story after the other. And they're not good, because you're the highest taxed people practically in the nation. And yet we get the short end of the stick on most of these situations. And always there's more money to fix it, when in fact it's about people issues. Let's, instead of the trucks that are broken down there, and there's still a great many of them, they got the luxury of being able to go to the newspaper and tell you, oh, everything's fine. It's not fine. The trucks are still broken. And if they have furloughs, you're going to see problems, because there's going to be a work shortage or work stoppage by mechanics. Now, you may not know that, and they don't talk about that, but there's been some dissension in the ranks. And that, it's not all that the trucks are broken. It's just that some of the mechanics allegedly are dragging their feet on fixing the trucks. So you get that kind of behavior. And these are drivers that are sharing this information with me. But you won't see that. But what you see is a comment to the public through the paper that, oh, everything is fine, we're back on track. I think this morning they're talking about recycling. You see, their focus is just bad. They can't pick up trash in this area for a couple of weeks. Yet you got a full coverage story with Suzanne Jones and all the famous people and all of that, and it's the same old people doing the same thing that can't deliver the basic services. But they'll tell you how great it is to have Opala recycle, which is, recycling is good. But let's get the trash to the recycler. That's what they're not doing. They can't pick up in time, and I don't know how it works. I would be embarrassed to go out and tell people about how great we are and how successful we are in recycling, and we could do much better, when in fact the system is built on a delivery system that is flawed, broken trucks, poorly managed, and a mayor that goes off to London to see the London Bridge, well, but not knowing that it's been, you know, it's moved. But anyway, that's what it is. That's what's happening. And there's this new discussion of Ansaldo, with the contract and what have you. Can I ask all of you, to, if you would be so kind, give me, because I'm sick and tired of going off and giving you my opinion of this, but how is it that we could get to this point of, with this company, and nobody's outraged and no one has canceled it? I mean, they can't perform, they can't deliver. And how do we get to that? Again, this isn't pick on Luffy Hanneman, but I'm going to remind you at every chance I get, and then you can go vote for him if you want to, and I'll stand back and get me a nice cold beer and laugh at you, because you deserve what you vote for. And in this case, this is, once again, Luffy Hanneman, the guy that the newspaper tells you he's ready. He's going to do it for you. And yet, you have this situation. And now, if they were to cancel, I thought I read that Bombardier was interested. Now, I don't have all the facts on that, but somewhere along the line. But let's say Bombardier gets involved. Now, follow this now. I don't want you to think that I'm throwing rocks at Mufi Hanneman for no cause. And it's not rocks. I'm just going to put the facts out there. So if Ansaldo developed and arrived at here and we got this problem with him now, and it's a big problem. Bombardier, Paul Overton, is the gentleman that was at the fundraiser in Pittsburgh, and a great many of the Bombardier people, that illegal fundraiser that Mufi Hanneman had, so they may put in for it. How about that? Good morning, caller. Comment or question?
Carol, can I go back to the garbage subject?
You can if you'd like to.
Yeah, you know what I wanted to know, Carol, is you just said Kaimuki and Kapahulu, but do you know if it's just those two districts, or what do you know?
I don't know where, and it was only because I was alerted by this, but if there's others, how about you? When do they pick up on yours?
The regular gray bin is Saturdays only.
Okay. This district, theirs will to be picked up on the 9th or something.
Yeah, and you know what we're seeing?
The 19th, I'm sorry.
Carol, what we're seeing in Nainahina, I'm sure other communities too, is that they're not completing their route. Like yesterday, they picked up my street, but then across the street, they didn't pick up their street. And they didn't come till like after 5 o'clock in the afternoon.
Right.
So there was no way they could finish the whole valley.
Right. Well, there's a little story to be told about that, and it could be that they don't have the trucks.
Ah.
Well, that's one.
But, okay.
But secondly, you see, if a person drove a route and was assigned a regular route and drove his route and met the needs of the contract, now anything after his route or his or her route becomes overtime. And it's possible that someone just hopped in the truck, drove over there, and all you need to do is lift a few cans and you get paid for that full route. And then you come back tomorrow and someone else will start hauling it overtime. This is the abuse that we see Peter Carlisle and his crew allows to continue to occur. We pointed it out to him before he got in, pointed out when he got in, and Hanneman was in, and nobody cares. That's why.
You know, I would... I've got Chang, unfortunately.
Well...
For my council member, but I will call the office tomorrow.
Well, yeah, Chang is...
Chang is a ding-dang.
Yes. I don't know what he is, but I can tell you he's been an elitist when it comes to responding to the questions. But again, that's what people voted for. And, you know, and that's what I think DeJou told you to vote for him because he was a good guy. Is that, I remember that.
Who, me?
No, not you, but DeJou told us that.
Chang was a good guy. Did he endorse him?
Somewhere down the line, he had some person that he had recommended. But isn't this the way things work in this town?
Oh, no, it's getting brutally... it's a brutal broken record by now.
Over and over and over again.
Oh, man.
And they don't want to talk to us. They won't respond. They won't give documents. They, you know.
That's what they've done, Carol, is they know that they can build walls.
Mm-hmm.
That the public just... I mean, even if you go to a hearing and you only have 1 minute to talk, I mean, what is up with that?
And you better say what they like or you won't get that minute.
True.
Yeah, they'll immediately tell you, well, you can't talk about that person. Let's be pono now. Let's be nice about it, right?
Thank you, Carol.
Yeah, okay, brother. Thank you. Well, again, everything that you see wrong in this city and in this state, you can be held accountable for it. Because while you didn't ignore the call... And you didn't drive a truck on time, you voted for them. And you vote for them over and over and over again. You don't want to get rid of your own city councilman because he's a nice guy. You don't want to get rid of your state representative because he or she is a nice guy. But everyone else's representative is the bad guy. So, you... are infatuated with failure. You have incorporated, you are like the abused entity. You've grown to submit to it. When you have a chance and that curtain falls behind you, you think, I'm going to vote for him because he's Democrat. Well, I'm going to vote for her because she's Republican. You never in your mind say, I'm going to not vote for him because they didn't deliver nothing, but my taxes went up, my funds went up, my registration went up, my fees went up, and they won't even answer the phone, and when they do answer the phone, they're rude. And you forget all of that because you don't want to get rid of your representative or your councilman. You don't want to do that. You want to pick up the paper and let the paper and the TV stations make your decision for you, who you should vote for. And I can tell you, you may not agree with what I'm saying to you, but this is what's occurring. Pavlov's dogs, you know. We respond, we become trained, we become receptive to little ticklers, and they tell us the buzzwords, and then you are told, oh, he has a war chest for his campaign. If I was you, if I heard a politician's name in the same sentence as war chest, I would dismiss him immediately, because you don't get war chest and feel and the monies unless you're for sale. Look at Nesta Garcia. You know, we talked about the thing that he was getting the money for $5,000 or something per month for note keeping. Now it's come out that he was also got some $30,000 for some association with Ensaldo. And for those of you out there in Mililani and Waipahu, well, you can keep voting for him. And those of you that vote for him because he's Filipino, or vote for me because I'm black, and, you know, hey, that can lead to your demise, too. That can lead to stinky garbage sitting on the sidewalk. That can lead to poor police coverage. That can lead to poor EMS, because I didn't task him to prove his worth. I voted because of his ethnicity or his color, or he's a cool dude, or he shows up and dance with the senior citizens at the Valentine's party. We need to get away from dancing to that old tune, folks. There's absolutely no way that you and I should be paying the taxes we pay when we have a system that's doubling. They say, we're going to privatize it. But they don't tell you that they're going to keep the same staff and still hire more city workers and more state workers, but they're going to farm it out. So they put some guy in that is not experienced, has no qualifications, but he's going to run that division. Because he could be as dumb as a rock. But what we've come to learn is that we farm it out, we privatize it. So you're paying his salary, you're paying his secretary's salary, and now you're paying a private party to do the work. We are tripling and doubling and tripling our expenses on simple projects. Roadways, federal government highways on their basis, you don't see potholes and that type of numbers or what have you, those large numbers. But we hire the same people, and they come along with cold plane and with the shovel and stomping it with their feet, and then 2 days later, 3 days later, you got another pothole. That's a lot of money. On holidays, you see the street lights go out. They've been out for 6 months. But then on a holiday, you come, you see a worker come. He's there, climb up the pole because he's getting overtime, you see, on a holiday. It's that kind of management we need to focus on. And I guarantee you, if you start thinking in that vein, folks, you won't have to worry about a lot of these things. But just remember, it's not your legislator that we need to get rid of. It's not your city councilman. It's someone else's. And as long as that prevails, And as long as that is a normal understanding, then you're doomed. And I would say you should, the best thing to do as a, if you continue this process, is just get some fly paper and wrap it around your neck and live with it. And quit complaining. Quit talking, you know. Know who you vote for and vote for who you know, not what they present to you. Keep a record. Remind yourself. Murphy Hanna. That's where the problem is. Remember, he stayed in for 6 years or 2 years out in his second term, and he handed off to Mr. Carlisle, the tourist, and now you're stuck. So I'll see you next week, and thank you for joining me. And I hope all of you understand the earlier show, not apologizing, but if I can do anything to get that message out, I will, and we'll tolerate the break in the break in communications. But thank you for joining me. Aloha.
He heard a knife by the holly sleeping. Oh, I dream I have you. Have you in my arms. Oh, but when I woke up...
And one thing I want to share with you. Next week I have Mr. Ra Tam, former council member of Ra Tam on. So please join me next week at the Carol Cox Show. We should have some healthy conversation. Aloha.
Tuning in to the Carol Cox Show, heard every Sunday mornings from 8 a.m. to 10 a.m. right here on K108. Tune in again next time for the Carol Cox Show right here at KWAI Honolulu.